All right, strap in, everyone. Today, we're going deep on a case that's equal parts fascinating and kind of unsettling, United States v. Salerno. And it grapples with a question that, honestly, sounds like something out of, you know, a dystopian movie. Can you be jailed for a crime you might commit, like in the future?
Yeah, it's a question that really cuts to the heart of our justice system. You know, it forces us to really think about, like, where's the line between keeping the public safe and protecting individual liberty? And the Salerno case, it really gives us this this powerful lens to examine that whole debate.
Absolutely. We've got a ton of sources here, court opinions, legal analogies. We've even got some stuff on, like, the history of the war on organized crime. But the mission here, our mission for this deep dive, is to really unpack this Supreme Court decision and, you know, and its implications. Like, what does it mean for us today?
And what's interesting is that Salerno, you know, it's not just some old legal precedent that's gathering dust. It's super relevant today, especially when we think about all the debates going on about bail reform and, well, even just how we define dangerousness, right?
Okay, so let's set the stage here. It's 1987, the war on organized crime, it's in full swing. And right into this whole charged atmosphere, in walks Anthony, Fat Tony Salerno, alleged boss of the Genovese crime family.
And this isn't just your typical run-of-the-mill mob bust. Salerno, in his case, they become a kind of test case, you could tell, for this brand new tool the government has, the Bail Reform Act of 1984.
So the Bail Reform Act, this isn't about, like, someone skipping town, you know, fleeing to avoid trial. We're talking about detaining someone before trial because they're considered, what, a danger to the community. That's a lot of power for the government to have, don't you think?
It is. It is. And Salerno, along with his co-defendant, Vincent Cafaro, they become the poster children for this whole controversial part of the act. The government, their argument was that their alleged mob ties, well, that alone made them too dangerous to release, even before they'd been tried, even before they were convicted of any specific crimes.
Hold on. So they're basically saying we're going to lock these guys up based on the fact that they might commit a crime later on. What happened then? Did the courts just go along with that?
Well, there was some pushback, definitely. At first, the district court actually sided with the government. They ordered Salerno and Cafaro detained. But then the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, they stepped in and said, whoa, hold up. They declared the Bail Reform Act unconstitutional. They said it violated this fundamental right to due process.
Now, for folks listening who maybe aren't, you know, lawyers or law students, due process basically means everyone deserves a fair legal process before you can take away their freedom. Like, that's a cornerstone of our whole justice system, right?
Exactly. And the Second Circuit, they saw this preventive detention thing. They saw it as a direct threat to that whole principle. They basically said, look, you can't just lock someone up based on a hunch or some prediction, right? They deserve their day in court before you can take away their freedom.
So you've got this clash of opinions, right? And this basically sets the stage for a showdown at the highest court in the land, the Supreme Court. And that's where things get really interesting.
Right. The Supreme Court, they're facing this huge question. Can you sacrifice individual liberty in the name of public safety, even before someone's proven guilty?
Big question. And how did the court deal with this? How did they navigate this super complex issue?
Well, Chief Justice Rehnquist, he wrote the majority opinion. And, well, he walked a tightrope, you could say. He said, okay, due process is important. Presumption of innocence, that's important. But then he made this crucial distinction. Pretrial detention, he argued, in this kind of case anyway, it wasn't about punishment.
That seems like a tricky line to draw. I mean, if you're holding someone against their will, how is that not punishment?
Okay, so Rehnquist, he argued that it's about preventing future harm. He said, look, this is a regulatory measure, not a punishment. Basically, the government has a really strong interest in keeping dangerous people off the streets, even if they haven't actually been convicted of a crime yet.
Mm. So it's like a public health measure, right? We quarantine people who have a contagious disease to stop it from spreading. Are they saying it's the same logic with potential criminal activity?
Yeah, that's a great analogy. But as you might imagine, not everyone on the court was on board with this logic. Justices Marshall and Stevens, they dissented. And their arguments, they really highlight the potential dangers of this whole preventive detention thing.
Yeah, and this is where you start to get into those, like, what-if scenarios, right? And some of those scenarios, they can get pretty unsettling. Pretty quickly.
For sure. Justice Marshall, he was super worried about, like, chipping away at the presumption of innocence. Jailing someone for a crime they might commit, he said, that sets a dangerous precedent. Like, it opens the door to people being detained for, well, almost any reason.
So instead of innocent until proven guilty, we end up with guilty until proven harmless. That's a scary thought.
It is. And Justice Stevens, he had similar concerns. He was worried about prosecutors overstepping their bounds, you know, like, What if they start using detention as a weapon to go after unpopular defendants or, well, just anyone who rubs them the wrong way?
It really makes you think, like, how do you define dangerousness? It's so subjective. And it feels like it could be really easy for bias to creep in, you know, whether it's intentional or not.
Yeah, you've hit on a really key point. And this is where those safeguards that Rehnquist put in place, those become super important. He was very clear that the government can't just lock someone up based on a gut feeling.
Okay, so what were some of those safeguards? What did he put in place?
Well, first off, the evidence had to be clear and convincing. So we're talking about a high standard of proof, right? Not just, oh, we think this might happen. Second, the hearings had to be adversarial, so both sides get to make their case. And maybe most importantly, the judges, they had to give specific reasons for their detention decisions. Like, it had to be in writing, llama rubber stamping.
So, okay, the majority opinion basically said, yeah, you can detain someone based on this idea of potential dangerousness, but there are nulls. Specific procedures, you have to follow them. But even with all that, it still feels like there's a lot of wiggle room, right, for interpretation, for potential misuse.
There is, and that's why the dissenting opinions are so important. They force us to think about the potential downsides of this approach, to be cautious, you know, to make sure it's not being abused.
All right, so we've set the stage, explored the main arguments in Solero. But before we get into the long-term impact, I want to pause here for a sec. What do you think about all this? The government being able to detain people based on dangerousness, does that sit right with you, or does it feel like it crosses a line? Like, is it a necessary evil or a slippery slope? Something to think about.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting to look back and see, like, how has Salerno actually played out in the real world? Has it been this, like, you know, precise tool for public safety? Or has it turned out to be what Justice Marshall was worried about? You know, a blunt instrument that's eroding the whole presumption of innocence thing.
Right. That's the big question, isn't it? I mean, we know it gave us this whole framework for dangerousness hearings. But how has that actually worked in practice?
Well, the application has been, let's just say it's been a bit inconsistent. You know, trying to predict if someone's going to be dangerous in the future, that's inherently tough. We're not looking at past crimes here. We're trying to assess risk. And there are so many factors to consider.
So, like, someone's criminal history, what the current charges are, maybe if they're involved in a gang, that kind of stuff.
Exactly. But here's the catch. Those factors, they can be interpreted in so many different ways. It's all very subjective, you know. What one judge might see as a huge red flag, another judge might just, like, shrug it off.
And that's where those safeguards that Rehnquist put in place, those become super critical, right? The high standard of proof, those adversarial hearings, the fact that judges have to give those specific reasons for their decision. That was supposed to prevent this whole, you know, arbitrary detention thing.
Absolutely. Think of them like guardrails, you know? They're supposed to keep the system on track, make sure we're not detaining people unconstitutionally. But even with those guardrails, there's been a lot of criticism. Some people say that Salerno, you know, it actually ends up impacting certain groups more than others.
You're talking about, like, racial bias and the fact that people of color are disproportionately represented in the criminal justice system.
Yeah, exactly. There have been studies that show even when you account for things like how serious the charges are and, you know, someone's past criminal history, people of color, they're still more likely to be labeled as dangerous and denied bail.
So a system that's meant to protect public safety might actually be, you know, making things worse, perpetuating these existing inequalities. That's disturbing.
It is. And it shows just how important it is to be vigilant, to keep scrutinizing this. Salerno can be a really powerful tool, but only if we're using it responsibly and with, you know, a real focus on fairness.
Now, it's only fair to mention that, you know, there are arguments in favor of Salerno. It's not all bad.
Right. I mean, the strongest argument is that it has, without a doubt, prevented some violent crimes from happening. When it's used correctly, it keeps dangerous people off the streets, and that can potentially save lives.
And that's, you know, it's a really valid point, especially when you think about how devastating violent crime can be. But how do we balance that with, you know, protecting individual rights and making sure the system isn't being abused?
Yeah, we keep coming back to this, like, this core tension, right? It's this constant balancing act, and there aren't any easy answers. But I think one really crucial thing is having robust alternatives to pretrial detention.
So instead of just automatically locking someone up, we need to be exploring other options, options that address those risk factors we were talking about, but, you know, without taking away someone's freedom.
Exactly. Think about, like, electronic monitoring or supervised release programs or even, you know, mental health and substance abuse treatment. These things, they can be really effective. They can help reduce risk without having to resort to incarceration.
So it's about finding the least restrictive way to get the outcome you want. Like, yeah, protect the public, but don't infringe on people's rights unless you absolutely have to.
Exactly. It's got to be a nuanced approach, you know? You have to look at each case individually. There's no, like, one-size-fits-all solution here.
That makes sense. I'm curious, though, how have other courts, like, how have they interpreted Solano? Have they stuck to the limits the Supreme Court set, or, you know, has it expanded?
Well, that's where things get even more complicated. Remember, Salerno, that case was about federal law. But the principles from that case, those have definitely influenced state courts too. Some states have adopted similar standards for, dangerousness, but others are more cautious.
So we've got this, like, this patchwork, different approaches all over the country, like national standard for preventive detention.
Exactly. And that lack of consistency, well, that raises concerns about equal protection, about due process. I mean, if your freedom depends on like what state you happen to be in, is that really fair? Are we treating everyone equally under the law?
These are some really big questions, and they get to the heart of this whole debate about public safety and individual rights. We're talking about something much bigger than just Salerno now.
We are. We're talking about the very foundation of our justice system. And as we move on to, the more practical implications of Salerno for lawyers and everyone working in the system, I think this tension, this balance, it's going to become even more apparent.
Yeah. Okay. Before we do that, though, I want to throw this back to our listeners. What are your thoughts on this whole idea of preventive detention, necessary evil, slippery slope? Something to think about. All right. So let's kind of shift gears here a bit and talk about, like, what's Salerno actually mean for, for lawyers, for the folks working in the criminal justice system every day? What can we learn from this case? And how can we actually use those lessons in, in practice?
Yeah, that's a really important question because, like we've been talking about, Salerno isn't just some, theoretical thing. It has real-world consequences, for defendants, for prosecutors, for judges, everyone.
Totally. So let's break it down. What are the key takeaways here for each of those players?
Okay, so for defense attorneys, I think one of the biggest things is that Salerno really, like, it raises the stakes at that detention stage. They can't just sit back and wait for trial to start making their arguments.
So you're saying the fight, it starts right away at the dangerousness hearing?
Exactly. That's where everything, that's where it all goes down. Defense attorneys, they got to be ready to go, challenge the government's evidence, present their own arguments, and really, push for alternative release conditions.
It sounds like those safeguards that Rehnquist put in place, they're not just like some theoretical things, they're tools, tools that defense attorneys can actually use to protect their clients' rights.
Exactly. That's why it's so important for defense attorneys to really like to know Salerno inside and out and all the case law that's come after it. They got to know how detention works, what standard proof is needed, and all the ways they can, they can challenge the government.
So it's all about strategy, knowing the rules of the game and using them to, to fight for your client.
Right. Now, on the flip side, prosecutors, they need to be just as aware of the limits that Salerno puts in place. They can't just throw around this dangerousness label without having, without having real evidence to back it up.
So just saying, hey, this person is a danger, that's not enough to get a detention order anymore.
Nope, not at all. Salerno demands specifics. Prosecutors got to connect the dots. They got to show clear and convincing evidence that links the defendant's past behavior or their current circumstances to a real risk of them committing another crime.
So no more like vague generalizations or relying on, on stereotypes. It's got to be concrete facts and solid arguments.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not just about the evidence either. Prosecutors got to be really careful about, about bias affecting their decisions.
Right, like we talked about before, everyone in the system, judges, prosecutors, defense attorneys, everyone needs to be constantly checking themselves for bias, whether it's intentional or not.
Definitely. Salerno gives us this framework, but it's up to the people in the system to use it fairly. And that brings up another big point for both sides, both prosecutors and defense attorneys, knowing when Salerno even applies. Like, what kinds of cases does it cover?
Yeah, and that seems like it could get tricky. So how do you figure out when Salerno is relevant and when it's not?
Well, that's where things get kind of complicated. Remember, Salerno, that specific case was about some really serious charges, organized crime, racketeering. The Supreme Court, they were really clear that this whole preventive detention thing, that's for the most serious crimes.
So there's a risk of like taking the logic of Salerno and stretching it too far, using it for like less serious offenses.
Exactly. Like using it for, I don't know, nonviolent drug offenses or petty theft, that would raise some major constitutional questions.
It's like using a sledgehammer to crack a walnut, right? Wrong tool for the job.
Yeah, perfect analogy. And that's why lawyers and, legal professionals, they got to use their judgment here. Be smart about it. When to use Salerno, when not to. It's not some like magic bullet. Every case is different.
So it's really a reminder that like law isn't just about these abstract rules. It's about, how those rules get interpreted, how they get applied out in the real world.
Yeah, for sure. And that's what makes Salerno so you know, so interesting, so challenging. Even all these years later, it still makes us think.
Well, we've definitely covered a lot today, the history of Salerno, what it means for lawyers, all of it. But I think the biggest takeaway for me is this, like, this constant tension, public safety versus individual liberty. It's about keeping people safe, but also protecting their rights. And that's not easy.
Yeah, and that tension, that's something we're always going to be wrestling with, you know? As a society, as legal professionals, even just as people, Salerno gives us this framework, but it's up to us to make sure we're using it the right way, ethically, responsibly, and to remember that, you know, the decisions we make, they have real consequences for people.
It's a big responsibility, but it's one we got to take seriously, right? So as we wrap up this deep dive on United States v. Salerno, I want to leave you with this. This case, it's not just some history lesson. It's a legal precedent that's still shaping our justice system right now. So keep thinking about it. Keep talking about it. And think about, you know, what can you do to make sure we're striking the right balance between safety and liberty? Thanks for joining us, everyone.